Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the 400th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I am a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
And I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and a professor at the University of Alberta and the director of Program of Practice Support at the College of Family Physicians of Canada.
Now, Mike, 400 podcasts, that's a lot of therapeutic nihilism.
Yes. So, and exactly, James. So a lot of the time we're perceived when we report the evidence as being nihilists. And so we wanted to dedicate this podcast to, I wouldn't go as far as to say refute that myth, but provide some kind of feedback on our perception of what we've been talking about for the last 400, yeah, just keep repeating that in your mind, 400 podcasts.
And not that it makes any difference, but this, I think, is either the second or third podcast of those 400 that we've actually been in the same room.
It is. I remember the first time we were in the same room, it was an old chemistry lab at UBC.
Yeah.
And there were actual traps to catch vermin in the room with us.
And it was a meth lab.
I was wondering where UBC made of all of this money. I like that industrial nature.
And then the only other one that I think we were in the same room together was when we were doing erectile dysfunction. And that we never got above the voice of a 14-year-old boy in that one. So hopefully
we'll
we're going to improve upon that with that. But no, it's really true that, you know, we get sort of, and criticized, I think, is a strong word. I think a lot of people hopefully get appreciate and like what we're doing. But, you know, like even my students, they just recently sent me an email. They made a meme, which I don't know if you know, it's like an image, you know, that sort of stuff. And it really is, and what it was a picture of Keanu Reeves from the, you know, sort of Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, where he's looking in shock. And under it, it says, "When McCormack has you questioning if anything really works." You know, and it's, you know, we get a lot of that sort of feedback.
Or the kind of Don Quixote thing where you're tilting at windmills and you know, we're just trying to change things. So, and that gets you to this idea that I've been called before, and I'm sure you have, an iconoclast. And that's someone who attacks cherished beliefs or traditional institutions because they're based on error or superstition. And while that would seem reasonable on a basic level, I don't think our intention is to bring something down. I certainly didn't embark on this to tear down an old institution. It just happens that the evidence is contrary to some of those old institutions.
Yeah, and at least we wouldn't publicly say that.
Thank you for clarifying that. And then we've also been called cynical B words, and that B word may be the same as the old term for child born out of wedlock.
Yeah. Yeah, but we try not to do that. But we do have in our byline BS.
That is true. And and what is cynicism? Well, it's bitter, it's sneering, distasteful, contemptuous, and pessimistic. Mm-hmm. And the attitude is scornful and jaded with negativity. So James, I mean that.
Well, that sounds like me.
There is a picture of you.
Yeah, exactly. No, and so one of the things we've talked about in the past for the 400 episodes is we don't want to be cynical, because that's just, you know, sometimes it's just mean and boring, and we really want to come across as being, you know, healthy skeptics. And I it is tough to sometimes stay that path, but that's where we're both coming from. And you know, we're going to talk about in this podcast about things that do work, but we wanted to just sort of go through that process of the wording and you know, what some people say about us.
Right. And so we've called this, for lack of a better term, the happy news from a so-called nihilist. It's a bit of a play on Alanis Morissette's album about her saying she was a so-called infatuation junkie. So we've been called nihilists. So, and what is a nihilist? They're total rejection of established laws and institutions. They're an extreme form of skepticism. They denial of all existence or possibility of objective base of truth. And I don't think we'd go quite that far.
I hope not, because I think you've sometimes gone down the path and I bring you back. But no, I don't think we're that far. Yeah.
But so we do go to be a skeptic, though. And a skeptic is someone who's not easily convinced or has doubts and reservations. And I'm not to the point where you and I have gone on the record, and many evidence-based people have kind of refuted this about statins probably work.
Yeah.
And as insane as that sounds, with over 100,000 people studied now in mm-hmm. randomized controlled trials, there are some who still refute even that.
And we might even want to define what we might mean by work, because, you know, it's a tricky thing. When we say something works, I mean, there's two things. They either something works on symptoms, but just because it has, the way we define work in clinical trials is that if it has an effect on average more often than placebo, we mm-hmm. say it works. But that in no way, shape, or form means it's going to work in everybody.
Right. And that's one of the things that people get frustrated with when they hear something like antidepressants. And you mm-hmm. you say that number needed to treat is 10. And people think, so only 1 in 10 are benefiting. It's also a misunderstanding there, because 40% of placebo is 40% of a group in placebo is benefiting. That means that with the extra 1 in 10 from the drug, that means that 50% of people will be better if you give them a drug. So 1 in every 2 is actually better.
Yeah, which is why it's sort of clinical experience is often different than the way that the studies come out.
Right.
And so people say, well, I see quite a number of people that get better on antidepressants. You do, but it may have nothing to do with that drug.
Right.
And that's the wonder of medicine, is that, you know, you just distract the patient till they get better on their own. And but, you know, so that's the concept of working within a symptom based thing. And then there's, how do you figure out if a drug works when it comes to sort
prevention.
Of risk reduction?
Yeah.
Is one, you can never assess it in a patient. You just kind of hope. And when we're talking about risk reduction, you can only reduce risk so much. And we're going to get into that a little bit.
Yeah.
But, you know, if a person's risk of something is only 2%, you can only reduce that by another 2%.
And that's if the medication or intervention works perfectly.
Yeah.
So when you've heard us say before, and we certainly are perceived as skeptical in this way, whenever I hear a biologic mechanism for something to occur that's like a preventative intervention, so someone describes even an SSRI that's newly invented but hasn't actually been tried in clinical trials, I'm skeptical if you just tell me that, well, it binds to this receptor.
Yeah.
And that's because we've been burned by that so often. And you have to go back. There's a guy named Henry Mencken, and he had a great quote, which is, to every complex problem, there is a simple answer. It is neat, plausible, and wrong.
Yeah. No, exactly. And it's not that we're not against pharmacology. I think pharmacology is really cool. And I would love to know how these things work. But as we've said in previous podcasts, I care a lot more about if it works. And so that's the mechanisms lead us to potentially studying the drug to see if it works. Mm-hmm. That's how we get there. We study it in rats and all that sort of stuff. But just because you think you have a mechanism doesn't mean it's going to work. And again, when you say things like that, people go, oh, well, you're just being a cynic and all that sort of stuff.
Right.
And you and I, we've all had these experiences where, I mean, I've told you the story about where I was asked to debate a cardiologist. And this was on the Jupiter trial.
Yes.
And this was back in 2009. And it was in front of 200 Toronto cardiologists. And it was sort of a discussion about the value of doing high sensitivity C-reactive protein. And we ended up writing an article about this sort of
yes,
concept.
Yes, absolutely.
And it was really about, is it of any value in, you know, individual patient clinical care? And I won't say the name of the guy. I think it was Jacques Genet, though. And... but he was one of the lead authors of the Jupiter trial, and it was actually a very easy debate to win, because you can show just the problem with high sensitivity C-reactive protein is that it's a very valuable thing from a research perspective, but when you try to apply it to an individual patient, it's got such variation, biologic variation in the test itself, and really it doesn't improve our assessment of risk. It was really easy to win that sort of debate. And you kind of know you've won a debate when at the end the person says, that's why you and people like you are doing such harm to the people of Canada.
That's what I yelled out from the audience. That was actually me.
I'm pretty sure it was him that said that. And, you know, that's the type of feedback that we're getting. Even though we're not trying to destroy anyone's career or their, you know, their studies or anything. The Jupiter trial was
a good trial, actually.
It was a great trial. There's some issues about it. But that's the sort of thing we run into, in that we're trying to, you know, put these things in the context. And there is a big difference between what works in populations and what works at the individual level. And that's why we wanted to sort of define what work works mean, what work means.
Right. And so that, and that's a key thing, because people, when we tell how well a certain intervention works, many people are disappointed, but they're having expectation, just like we all do, about all of our interventions, that they will have kind of a 70% absolute benefit and those kind of things. And yet we know that they actually, all of them virtually have very small effects. But we'll get into the ones that actually have a bigger effect. But we have a question for the audience to reflect on, to determine if they are a skeptic as well. A quiz. So think about these things. Do you prefer reassuring misrepresentation or uncomfortable honesty? Which do you prefer?
I like both.
I like the first more, reassuring misrepresentation. Do you believe it is possible to make an asymptomatic person feel better?
Yeah. Which is a great line, because you, now that, that's always tricky, because the truth is yes. Now, I know where you're going with this one, because I've used this line, you know, you can't make an asymptomatic patient feel better, but I'm relatively speaking right now asymptomatic, but if you gave me a whack load of money,
you feel better,
or a new computer, I would feel better. But we only have a few drugs like that, which are, you know, cocaine, meth, heroin, and those sort of stuff. But so in general, I totally agree, you can't make an asymptomatic person feel better.
Yeah, but and I don't think they're heavy on anyone's prescribing list, or certainly not someone who maintains a license.
Not in this century.
That's true. True enough. Do you believe a person without risk can have their risk lowered?
Yeah, a very good point. And then that's what we got back with. If it's 2%, you can only go so low.
Right. And if your risk of having a fracture is 5% in a given year, in a given 10-year period, it's a bisphosphonate will do something, but it won't be probably meet a threshold by which most people would think it's reasonable to take it regularly.
Yeah.
Do you believe that patients are like an ideal gas and they will expand to fill any volume?
Well, you're the expert on gas in general, so why don't you answer that question?
And I assume you're applying that because of my long career in Alberta.
Yes. It wasn't a personal thing.
It wasn't. No, I didn't think he would stoop that low.
No.
Yeah. One of my colleagues once told me that we were trying to figure out how we can possibly get a dent down in our wait list and the high burden of patients waiting in the for our urgent care center. And I just felt terrible for them. There were like 40 people first thing in the morning at times. And I felt really bad about that. And he was a true nihilist. And he said, don't even try, because patients are like an ideal gas. They'll expand to fill any volume. But anyway, the positive news was we did make a big breakthrough there. We didn't exactly believe that ourselves. So which is more dangerous, believing what you're told without hesitation or questioning what you're told?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, you and I subscribe to this in with all our passion, I think, is that, and it's not questioning just to be a jerk. It's just we get burned so often, and it's possible that what you're hearing is not true. And again, true could be, you know, we might both agree that this drug works, but we need to know the magnitude. So it's all a degree of workedness. And I know that's not a word.
So let's just remember that I'm going to have a couple quotes here. This is from Abraham Lincoln, and I think it's a great way to look at things. So we can complain because a rose bush has thorns, or we can rejoice because a thorn bush has roses.
Yeah.
And I think that's such an insightful, it's the kind of glasses half empty, but put much more eloquently. And it's us kind of reflecting on, yeah, we have these things maybe don't work 100% of the time in 100% of patients, but they do have some pretty, we have some interventions with some pretty impactful outcomes, and we have made some significant headway. So we're going to spend kind of the rest of the podcast and the next podcast talking, laying the groundwork for things that really do work and reminding us that even evidence, when you use it, can show very positive benefits.
And clearly what we're going to be talking about is, it's our bias that we're putting on this, because we, you know, some people, we'll say we think this is fairly reasonable. We realize there are people who go, that is not reasonable at all. Mm-hmm. And also people will say, well, what about this and that? So this is just an example to, as much as possible, say, We don't want to always come across as saying nothing works. And that's the point of this. We figured we'd get there after 400 podcasts.
So this one is, this first one we're going to do, it digs back to 1967, which was probably one of the most important years in our nation's history, because I was born then, James.
Really?
1967.
I thought you were created, but keep going.
So the effects of treatment on morbidity and hypertension. So this was a trial that took patients. And of course, back then, we were just beginning to discover that blood pressure was bad for you. Because, and interestingly, in medicine, we had to be informed by the insurance industry, who said, hey, people with high blood pressure die sooner and they have bad things happen to them. So we started to reflect, could we actually bring blood pressure down? And they focused on diastolic back then. These patients were averaging 115 diastolic to 129. And the mean BP was 187 on 121.
Yeah. And if you were to measure that today, and it's almost a reflection on where we are today, you know, back then when you read those numbers, you go, well, that's kind of mild hypertension.
Yeah.
And nowadays, these numbers actually don't give the patient a stroke, just the healthcare provider who measures it. But back then it was considered ethical to do a placebo-controlled trial of this, because we didn't know. Now, blood pressure was being treated before this trial, mm-hmm. but we just didn't know if it was beneficial.
Right.
You know, so right. We were using the medications without that evidence, which basically is exactly what we've done with osteoporosis so and diabetes and the cholesterol and all that sort of stuff. But this was the VA1 trial, as you talked about. But yeah, keep going.
And the line that James just mentioned, the mild hypertension, that was actually one of the titles for these trials back in the 1968 was one of the trials, with an average BP of 200, I think.
Yeah, systolic. Exactly.
So what happened? Well, they got up to three drugs. They were male and around 50 years old. They followed them for only a year and a half. Like that is remarkable now, to see a clinical benefit in a year and a half. But remember, this is an era with virtually no other interventions.
Yeah. Now, the only comparative one right now would be if you take the trials in the over 80.
Yeah.
You know, they see a benefit within a couple of years mm-hmm. with the otherwise very, very healthy person. And you can get that a benefit within 2 years, whereas most hypertension trials are, you know, the 5-6 year
but in a 50-year-old age group and have a benefit in a year and a half, and these kind of benefits which we're going to list. So what happened? Well, in the placebo group, 5% of them died, but in the treatment group, 0% died. Now, I'm not a statistician.
No, you're not.
But those things seem to be different to me.
Yeah. And I think if I remember correctly, I think there was 70 people in each. Was it 70 people in each group?
I can't remember. I think it wasn't many.
But it wasn't many. And so, you know, like even with just 5% dying, you go, that's to have that many deaths in that age group.
In that time frame.
Indicates that something is going on.
Right. And the other one was where they had a pooled outcome, everything ranging from retinal hemorrhage all mm-hmm. the way to death. And that was 39% of people in the placebo arm had that versus 3% in the treatment arm. Now, again, not a statistician, as you pointed out and like to remind me all the time mm-hmm. when I try and do addition, by the way. But that seems different to me.
Yeah, I think most mathematicians would say 39 is different than 3. So the caveat to this is that this number is actually artificially larger than what we've seen in other trials, because they use some surrogate endpoints.
Right.
So they didn't. This wasn't just heart attacks or strokes and that sort of stuff. When you looked at them, they were also reduced. But these were, you know, things like retinal hemorrhages, which are
softer outcomes. They're still serious.
Yeah.
Serious.
Yeah. And these are not necessarily captured right now in any of the clinical trials, primarily because nobody probably gets them with blood pressures of the 145 or very small percentage. But, even, you know, if you look at that, the numbers needed to treat are around 3, or about, you know, like I said, a 33% absolute reduction, which is way, way, way above anything else that we've ever almost any other treatment that we have.
Right.
And, you know, if you actually started to look at the numbers of, you know, heart attacks and strokes, we get to the numbers needed to treat of maybe, you know, 7 or 8 or 9 or 10, which mm-hmm. is still not bad.
No.
But what's important to remember is in these people is that over a year and a half, people with 187 over 121, 60% of them had nothing.
Yeah. It's fascinating, right?
Yeah. And I think, you know, most people get nervous if you have that in blood pressure for a week, but 60% had nothing. And it, again, knowing these results helps guide your level of comfort and your expectation of what you need to be able to do.
Right. And moderate some of that panic that's been instilled in us. I think this is a good trial, and that to remind everyone about that, if you have a pause about treating high blood pressure, like there is potentially larger benefits to be attained by treating real hypertension, very high hypertension. Mm-hmm. Than than maybe you anticipated. The trouble that we're seeing now, where we're, is 140 better than 120? Is 120, like that? Those are, this isn't where we started. We started with 200, 190, and bringing those numbers down.
Yeah. And no, I mean, this is, it's sort of like the Titanic. I mean, this sort of blood pressure is, you got the Titanic going through and you're, you know, blasting away that iceberg.
Yeah.
Whereas when we get to 141, you're just rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic.
Absolutely. So let's talk about some of the other hypertension trials that lend to that body of evidence. So these are trials like CIST-URO, SHEP, CIST-CHINA, all of these kind of trials that were from the 90s, that started in the late 80s and in the 90s, that really lay a groundwork for our understanding. And they started often with a mean systolic of somewhere around 170 and got them down to less than 150. So about a 20 millimeter mercury or more drop.
Yeah. Sorry, actually, we should add just that previous trial, just as you're talking about the amount of drop, is it took three drugs to get that benefit.
Yeah, that's right.
So some of the trials that we see now are single drug entity trials or getting them to, you know, 140 versus 120. So this is not just a single drug. Mm-hmm. And this is the same with this, is where they're getting, you know, 15 or 20 drop in systolic blood pressure, which you literally can't get with a drug.
Yeah.
With a single drug.
So if you're very hypertensive and you start on a hot and you end up titrating to a high dose to eke up to those extra millimeters of mercury, you might get 15.
Maybe.
Yeah. 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 And that's not accounting for the placebo
effect. Yeah. And that's if you bleed them during the time.
You are the nihilist.
I'm the humorist.
So what they found in these was a 30 to 35% relative risk reduction in cardiovascular disease. And so varied, 40% for stroke, 25% for cardiac, 25%. These are relative reductions. And sometimes reductions in mortality were seen, sometimes around a 15% relative reduction in mortality. So what might that look like over a five-year stretch? Well, it's kind of a 3 to 4% reduction in stroke, a 5 to 6% reduction in cardiovascular disease overall, and around up to a 5% reduction in mortality. So mm-hmm. not numbers to sneeze at, but not the numbers we were seeing earlier, because they started higher mm-hmm. and that was in an era with virtually no other interventions for cardiovascular disease. Yeah.
Now, you know, if you can do the math, that means 95% roughly don't benefit.
And don't benefit because they're avoiding the event anyway.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's the thing to be aware of. But I agree with you, Mike. I think, you know, if I could have a drug that reduced mortality or major cardiovascular events by about 5% over 5 years, I would probably take it if it didn't cause side effects.
Right.
And it didn't cause, wasn't, you know, that expensive or annoying to take and so on. So I think that's where we've come from, where at that point people said, yeah, most people would probably want to be treated, because I'm not a big fan of medications. I don't think you are relatively, but that's probably big enough for most people. And in my experience in talking to literally hundreds of people about this, 5% seems a lot to a lot of people.
Yeah.
And they would take it for that.
Yeah.
But that's often not what we're talking about.
Yeah.
But this is, so really when you're asked about blood pressure, the number I sort of float around is the absolute benefit over 5 years is somewhere between 2 and 5%.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the, you know, the person who's 30 years of age, who's got a 141, the benefit's zero.
It's very close to zero.
Yeah.
If you did a trial of 200,000 people with each arm, you might be able to
measure something
in the less than 1% range.
Yeah.
It would,
and that's getting blood pressure control with the 170s and the, you know, that sort of stuff. And then when you get to the 140s, you're pushing the edge of the 1 to 2%,
yeah,
maybe. And so if you know those numbers, it's you don't have to do a lot of risk calculations.
And in fact, it speaks to one of the other things. With the 30 to 35% reduction, you can almost, that is the number you can remember for almost all our preventative maneuvers. Now, not warfarin and the new NOACs and all of that stuff for stroke prevention.
Well, it's easy. That, I mean, it's just double that. It's about 60.
Absolutely.
It's about 60. It's two-thirds.
It's fascinating. You start kind of at 60, then you go to 30 for most interventions like statins, blood pressure management, and bisphosphonates, for example. They're somewhere around there.
Yeah, you could say 25, but debating how many angels can dance on the head of a pin.
And then you go to half that again if you're thinking about the newer agents. So the empagliflozin, the the liraglutides, a lot of like the evolocumab, they're all 15. So it's kind of easy to remember. 60, 30, 15 goes by halves each time. And those are the...
And we have to remember we have a bunch that are not zero. Now I'm being a therapeutic nihilist.
The DPP-4s, they're you're right that they have very few adverse events. People will say that to me. Well, they have very few adverse events. Yep, and they have very few... Well, I would go as far as to say no.
Benefits.
Therapeutic benefits. Yeah, yeah. So they're almost akin to glucosamine. Let's talk about something else that we can make, I think, relatively big impacts. And this is because now what we're talking about is the relative, the patient's absolute risk of having a bad event. And that is patients with heart failure, particularly those who have progressed and have admissions for them and things like that. Those patients will really benefit from three distinct drugs, the aldosterone antagonist, the beta blockers, and ACE inhibitors. Yes.
And we do have to define really benefit.
Yes, because, and we will. We will.
And we will get there.
Yeah, but for them, because their mortality is high, we are going to have a bigger impact on them. Mm-hmm. And this is the patients with systolic heart failure. We really do need to clarify that, unfortunately, that it's not all heart failure. So what do they do? Well, if you have a patient with about a 25% mortality per year, and you might think that that's really high, and it is quite high for mortality, something that serious, after the first hospitalization, it's not uncommon for patients to have that kind of risk, a 25% chance.
And that's
chance.
Probably, you know, sort of the class three heart failure people.
Yeah. Number needed to treat there to avoid death is, for aldosterone antagonists, is number needed to treat 16, beta blockers 14, and ACE inhibitors 18.
Yeah, which are, and again, the vast majority of people don't benefit.
Right.
But you're still getting, those are the sorts of numbers that are much greater than what we had with that asymptomatic blood pressure person.
Right. And there's benefits in, so what we just listed for you is mortality. There's also benefits in avoiding hospitalizations and things like that. So these drugs, and what's interesting to me, James, and I know I'm playing into your wheelhouse here, is ACE inhibitors, for example, you got to be at maximum dose.
Yeah.
But the difference between a lower dose ACE inhibitor versus a higher dose ACE inhibitor will not be as big as the additive benefits of the aldosterone antagonist.
Yes.
Like, do you know what I mean? If you come in with an ACE inhibitor of a moderate dose, let's say 2.5 to 5 of ramipril, if you get up to 10, it's not going to change mortality as much as adding in a spironolactone.
Yeah, we'll get to low doses later on. So I have not mentioned that yet. Just so you know.
It was me that brought it up. It was like a trap. It's like
and,
a trap for you.
Yeah. And so if you, and it actually goes to the same degree with blood pressure. If you sprinkle in three or four medications, it's way better than just dumping on a huge dose of one. And we've got a meta-analysis of the heart failure dosing drugs coming out in just a little bit. And it is surprisingly not overwhelming evidence that you need to get to these target doses. It's subtle. It could have a benefit, but certainly not with all classes of it. But no, you're right. I think, and that's why. Well, I don't know if it's why you see it, because I don't know if people think about evidence when they use these medications. But it's why when a person is in heart failure, they're put on all three.
Right.
My concern is when you put on all three at maximal doses
for someone who is unfamiliar with these medications.
Who's never been on them before, and then they go home with blood pressures of 20/10 and wonder why they feel
tired and
they're a little weak.
So but it is a good reminder for us that there are these interventions that are well tested. I would say there's good research to support these, and they do find.
Yeah,
I think in most people's eyes, considerable benefit.
Yeah, and so you can put these numbers into perspective. You're looking at, like we talked about with real hypertension, we're looking at sort of the 2 to 5%, and in these guys, we're now up to 5 to 10%.
Right,
and so I that's that, and I think most people would go, these are really quite beneficial agents.
Right.
And but we're still talking 90 to 95%. But now this is over a year,
right?
Or 18 months, not the 5 years, and all that sort of stuff. That's why it's so important when we talk about numbers. There's always the caveat of how long are we talking about, and that perspective. But and there is a little bit of data is that they are symptomatically better as well. So it's not just mortality,
right?
There are
a lot of benefits from
symptomatic benefits. But in a person who is, you know, getting a number of side effects from these medications, the benefits may not outweigh them. Yeah. And that's where your job as a clinician really comes into play. And you know, Mike, as well as I do, that when the problem is a family doc or someone in primary care, you're very reluctant to change stuff when the person comes out of a hospital, because you almost in your head you go, well, they must know what they're doing.
Someone, it can't be me, but yeah, someone must know.
Someone, because they must have known what they're doing. And you know as well as I know, in the hospital setting, there is very little assessment of whether or not they're tolerating these drugs.
Well, because they're in hospital, they're laying in bed most of the time, and you know. But one thing I do want to point out for those of you who are kind of that. So you might have heard me say beta blockers have an NNT of 14 versus ACE inhibitors an NNT of 18. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that one is. Like, no. I'm not saying beta blockers are clearly way better because they're slightly lower NNT. These would have relatively large confidence intervals around them, so they're probably very similar. And some of you may wonder, well, are these drugs, when they're given individually with no background medications? And I have to say that it's important for you to understand, for example, in the aldosterone world, there was the drug eplerenone, which was studied. And in those trials, almost everyone was already on beta blockers and ACE inhibitors. So these drugs work when piled on together and still get these kind of benefits.
Yeah, and we, as you said, there are no head-to-head comparisons, and I don't think we need them.
No, I actually, again, we've talked about trials that are a waste of time. To me, that would be a waste of time. Mm-hmm. We know that when these drugs are added on the background of other medications, that they still result in this kind of benefit. Why do we need to know which one is slightly better? Yeah. And then someone will debate about the doses and the setting. And,
But that still doesn't. But it still doesn't mean there's a ton of work to do, which is making sure they tolerate the drugs.
Yeah.
And individual assessment, because there'll never be a study that helps for individual assessment. So that gives you oodles of work to do when it comes to that perspective. So that's anything else on heart failure? I mean, we don't have things in there. You know, there's no doubt that furosemide works.
Yeah,
it works symptomatic and it works acutely.
Yeah,
I mean, you can see it within, you know, not necessarily minutes, but certainly within
very fast. Amazing medicine to help patients in acute distress recover quickly.
Yeah, and
keep them at home in an oral dosing regime.
Yeah,
right?
And you know, there's two reasons why we don't actually have a lot of studies of furosemide. One, it was an older drug, mm-hmm. and two, you don't need them. Because the clinical experience is so clear.
Now,
know what I'm saying?
James.
You don't need, no one's clamoring to say, look, you know, we've got to show that furosemide works.
I'm going to play what you just said back to you later, and you will scream sacrilege.
Well, I do that anyway. But you know what
I,
but
it's
like, and we'll get into this, you know, there. I think it would be ridiculous to do, you know, a randomized placebo-controlled trial in general anesthesia. I mean, it's one, you need an N of one person.
Yeah, and you really, when you drew the bad straw in that, so I'm getting nothing operating on my abdomen.
Yeah.
We're just going to step back about 300 years and...
it's you can have general anesthesia or a bullet.
Bite down.
Not to shoot you. Yeah, bite on.
Okay. Yeah. No, that's all for heart failure.
Yeah. So let's do atrial fibrillation then.
Okay. Let's talk about AFib. And I think AFib, people are talking about the NOACs and all of that stuff. And we know from James and I and Mike Culver has been in to help present on that as well. The NOACs were really landmark drugs for other reasons, but their benefit over warfarin was small. So I'd like to actually step back to warfarin and talk about just how much benefit it gives versus placebo. So when you're talking about, and we're going to do that by looking at CHAD scores. So these are going to be estimations based on other data that we have, or combining data. So kind of the risk assessment data plus the data on benefits of warfarin from meta-analysis. So if you're a CHAD score 2, for example, and your risk of stroke in a single year is 4%, the benefit of warfarin is going to take 2.6% off that.
Yeah. So, and again, you can go back to the math. It's about you said 60%, but it's 2/3 off.
Yeah,
is basically what we're talking about.
Yeah, and then if your patient has a CHAD score of 4, their baseline risk is around, in a given year, is 8.5%. Mm-hmm. And the benefit that warfarin gives is a reduction, a takeaway from that, of 5.6%
per year. Yeah, and so these are numbers up in the getting close, in fact, not even, it's not more necessarily mortality, but up in the heart failure numbers.
Yeah.
And again, over a year, which means it's five times more beneficial.
In 5 years.
Than what you see in a five-year trial of hypertension.
Right. And so if you look at the highest, the CHAD score of 6, they have about an 18% chance of having a stroke in any given year. Now, that isn't all devastating strokes that lead to death.
Yeah. But it's my understanding is about 3/4 of strokes don't lead to long-term sequelae.
Right.
So that doesn't mean you go, oh, that's, I'm happy that I had a stroke. That's not nothing.
Yeah. But none of them are fun. You have to go into hospital and all of that stuff for a lot of them. So what's the benefit in a 1 year period for warfarin? It is 12%.
Yeah. Now we don't, there are no studies that actually show that
looked at that age.
So it's using some extrapolation, which we do all the time in medicine.
Right.
In theory, it should be that much.
Right.
You're hoping. And so when you sort of get to that sort of benefit, especially if you extrapolate it over 5 years,
the number needed to treat can become pretty impressive. So it's 11 in 5 years for a CHAD score of only 1, mm-hmm. but all the way up to a number needed to treat of 2 in 5 years for the CHAD
score. And you do have to be careful of that extrapolation, because eventually, if you extrapolated it to a lifetime, you're actually saving the people who are standing next to you, their lives.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but we at least know the benefit over 1 or 2 years for sure. And then you put that in the background of, what is the risk of bleeds and inconvenience, mm-hmm. and all that sort of stuff. And we'll give a shout out to the best site that I think we're aware of, which is the Spark tool that Peter Lohan put together. And he's constantly updating it. And I know there's an iPhone app or apps that you can use to do this. And it really is a very simple process, very similar to what we do with our CBD calculator, is mm-hmm. that you can just put the numbers in and have those conversations.
Right. And we've been pushing that site for years. I have never received a royalty check. Have you received anything, James?
What topic do you want to talk about now? And in fact, Peter gets no royalties and we get no royalties from the CBD calculator. I know from Peter's perspective and my perspective, your perspective, we developed these because everything else just annoyed us. And, we wanted to have something that we could put into the context of that would be useful. And in no way, shape or form are we saying that these are perfect, mm-hmm. by any stretch of the imagination, but they're a heck of a lot better than some of the things out there. But you have to know the caveats and all that. And some of the caveats are what we've already talked about before. So
I just say my past admin coordinator, James, when you're saying, because it ticked us off or whatever, I was saying to her, I had to give a talk on, the research that I've done over my career and what motivated me, et cetera. And I said, geez, I really realized that a lot of things I've done are because I was ticked off about how something was being misinterpreted. And then I did the research to kind of refute it. And so I was saying, God, that's quite a way to have a career, to be ticked off at things. And she said, Mike, it's a fine line between pissed off and passionate. And I thought that was just such an excellent way of looking at things. Like, it just depends on how you reflect on that kind of thing. Because now I say I was passionate.
Yeah.
About
that. When I become pissed off, I become very passionate. Yeah. So those are just some sort of
some cardiovascular,
and I was going to say asymptomatic, but they're not really asymptomatic. It's not certainly not heart failure is not asymptomatic,
right?
But those are the sorts of things, and we could very quickly just add in the things where we're looking at things like statins.
Yeah,
With statins, you're going to see about a 1-2% absolute risk reduction over 5 years if it's primary prevention. You might be able to sneak that up, maybe, to 5% in secondary prevention, and then if you give a dose
from 4% for low dose,
and
5% for high dose.
Yeah, I was going to be generous. I was going to go 5% and 7%, just because
I'm a very giving person.
I am a giving person, but those are the numbers that we're talking about. If you start with, again, as Mike said, you get almost all the benefit from that initial low dose. Do you get more with higher doses? Yeah. And the nice thing about statins, if you will, is no one collapses from hypocholesterolemia. And we've talked about that before. At least I don't think so. So those are pretty much all the numbers. I don't think anyone needs to listen to another podcast. If they listen to this podcast, they now know how to treat hypertension. They know how to use a statin. Mm-hmm. And we only haven't, we didn't do diabetes. Should we?
We were going to do diabetes next podcast.
Yeah, okay, we'll do diabetes next podcast. So anything else you want to add?
No, I think that's it. Stay tuned for more remarkable treatments.
Oh, it's brilliant. I there's no doubt about that. So I think we'll just leave it at that. So thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.